like red, white, and blue on a day without wind. Sergeant First Class Lloyd's shirt sleeve hangs. His right arm never made it aboard that lonely, homebound plane. His flight arrives and my heart fills with pride, but I know that can't fill the sleeve at his side.
How long have you been in the Navy?
Oh, me blame it, life.
I'm Jamie Britt.
And I'm Heath Britt.
And together we are E14. We have 40 years of naval service.
And each week we discuss a potpourri of topics, which we like to call smoke pit topics.
These are real world topics that concern us, our marriage, and our Navy with a sailor twist.
So join us each week as we dive into the deep end.
Booyah!
Welcome everybody back to the E14 podcast. It's just me today. I'm here with Brandon Lloyd. This is the fourth installment of Unique Breed of Badass. So we touched on Brandon's childhood. We touched on a guy that he met after death, Richard Arriaga. Now we're going to talk about the combat years, about his 5+ years of combat and his 17, 18 years in the Army. Hey, Brandon, welcome, man. Welcome back to the E14, buddy. How you doing?
And you know, it's always good to talk to you, Heath.
Yeah, brother. So we're a couple hours away from each other. You're in sunny Pensacola. I'm here in southeast Louisiana. How's everything over in Pensacola, brother?
Everything's great, man. Just getting over a sunburn, to be honest. I took me and Christy took the girls to the beach. It was one of those rough days where it's overcast and the wind's blowing, so you don't realize that the sun is really destroying your ass. And so that evening, you get in the shower, and I come out, and I'm like, "Oh, sweet Lord, I'm
lobster."
Yeah. Didn't even think about putting on sunscreen or anything. So I'm getting over that now. But it's been good. Everything's fine. Lots happened since the last time we talked. Just going and doing a little traveling in Texas and doing some speaking.
Yeah, hit on that real quick, dude, because you went to I guess it's the Wounded Warrior event down there in South Texas. So how'd that go, man?
So they call it the muster. It's the Warriors Weekend Muster, which is their biggest fundraiser. And they, for the last 2020 and 2021 were canceled, of course, for COVID. So they haven't been able to do their big fundraiser. And they had me this year as the keynote, giving the keynote speech. Alan West was there, who was he run for president a few years back. Great guy, retired colonel. It was a packed house, man. Well over 1,000 people there. You talk about an event that big you can go to and everybody gets a ribeye steak. Come on.
Yeah, man. You're fucking big dogs. Hey, for everybody listening, I just want to paint a picture. It's about 9:30 in the morning, so we're over here virtually bullshitting with each other. I got a glass of half-drink bourbon, and Brandon's
Do you really?
I do. Brandon's over twiddling his thumbs. I got a cigar, and I'm ready to talk about some Army shit. How about you?
I am too, always.
Good deal, man. So you joined the Army. Tell me a little about you joining the Army and how you became an infantryman.
All right. Well, I'll kind of transition from our last episode. We were talking about college and all that, and how I kind of got burned out on college football. And I'll say this. I did not take it for granted, the opportunity that I had. I knew what was in front of me. So when I gave it up, I knew what I was giving up as well. I just knew that I wasn't happy. That's not what I wanted, and I wasn't going to find it. I went and watched my brother graduate from Fort Sill, Oklahoma. He went in the split out program. So he went to basic training like before his senior year, whatever, however they do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
He was younger, still in school, but I went and watched him graduate, and watching them jokers march down. And I'm sure a lot of people have this story, watching those jokers march down the road, and you can hear them from so far away. And I just, something come over me, and I was just like, that's it. That's what the hell I'm looking for. That camaraderie, that bro, you could just, without even talking to them and not really knowing much about the military at that time, just that, the simple act of marching in a formation said so much to me that the motivation, it was a wrap, son. I told my mom, yep, this is what I'm doing. She looked, of course, my mom was
she was not a fan, right?
And no. Like, what are you talking about, man? Because at that time, I'm still on the full scholarship and everything. But I went back in and had a meeting with my coaches, because what people don't know is you don't sign a four-year scholarship to play football or to play anything. You get reevaluated every year. Typically, it's in the spring. You have spring training for football. And at the end of the spring, based on how you do, the coach will have you in, and they'll kind of renegotiate. They'll say, look, we're going to re-sign you. We're going to give you one of our scholarships again next year, or we're going to give your scholarship to somebody else because you ain't meeting the, you know, you didn't meet the cut or whatever. So, but I knew I was going to make it. I was good. I went in there and let them know I kind of wanted to not do what I did when I signed with UAB and kind of screwing everybody over. I was more aware this time. So I went in and wanted to make sure that they knew going in that they were going to have to find another tight end for the next season.
So Brandon, with that said, what level in college for a sophomore, junior, when you hit you in the face?
I was 2 years in, but I actually had 3 years of college done.
Okay.
So when I got in the military, I only needed like a semester of school for my undergrad. But now I had to take more than that through Harvard Extension School. I had to take more because they, for them to transfer all your stuff, you know, they make you take like however, whatever it was.
Yeah.
I had to take a lot. So at the end of the day, I had enough college credits because I was a knowledge seeker. I wasn't in college, especially when I got in the military. I wasn't necessarily doing it for a degree. I was doing it to learn things. When I had the opportunity, I would take college courses, but I had enough credits to get like 9 different degrees. And they're like, yeah, you might want to think about a degree plan. So I did. And then went on to get two different master's degrees, post-grad work, but that it was just to keep my mind fresh and to keep my mind, working, because medically, it's a perishable skill. And if you're not working a long time, you forget. But when I got back to Mobile after leaving Fort Sill, I went straight to a recruiter and I did my research. And that was in late 97 into 98. These days, the amount of information that's on the internet, if you walk into a recruiter's office not knowing it, you should not be able to be bullshitted these days.
Back then it wasn't like that.
Oh, no. It still happens today. I mean, because people just don't take the time to look into their future. They just assume and take things for face value, or they take somebody's word for it. Right. It wasn't the recruiter I didn't trust. I just didn't trust anybody.
DTA, yeah, baby.
That's right. This is on me. If I screw it up, I screw it up. So I went in there and, the whole – definitely am not the only one, but I had real high GT score. I could have taken any job in the military I wanted. But there's a guy next to me. He's going – I overhear him talking to his recruiter – and trying to get these waivers for everything. This dude was like an ex-convict. So he had to get 15 different waivers for
shit.
And I'm like, damn. So just, it don't matter what you can and can't have, because if you can't have it and you do, you just make a waiver. just make a little waiver, just write it on paper. Just excuse it. So what the point is, what's the point of even having standards? I remember thinking that. But pretty much he wanted to do a lot of things, and the recruiter kept telling him, no, it's not available. And then finally, the recruiter's finally like, look, man, we're going to be able to offer you one thing. And see that poster on the wall? It looks like Rambo. That's the infantry. That's all we got. And then when he said that, I looked up and saw it. I was like, oh, shit. And I told my recruiter, he's got like military intelligence or some linguist or something pulled up. And I'm like, no, get to the page that's got this dude on it.
Oh, like, Rambo.
I want that guy coming out of the water with his boonie cap on. And he goes, no, you don't want that. You know, he tried to talk me out of it. Not that he didn't try for too long. He realized that I meant business. I wasn't in there to play. I said, you either get it for me or I get up and I walk away. I don't need this. I'm still in college playing football. So, you know, you're going to have to, you don't have to sell me. I'm here to tell you what I want, basically. And so what they have was it's called Option 40. It's where you get basic training. You got a basic training in infantry and you sign in, you're at 11, what's called an 11 X-ray. You go to basic training. Once you're done with basic and AIT, you go over to airborne school and then straight to what used to be called, when I come in, it was called RIP, the Ranger Indoctrination Program. Now it's RASP, Ranger Assessment and Selection. Well, so it's all there at Fort Benning. It's all set up and it's a contract. And, you know, I didn't realize it, looking back on it now, I didn't realize a regiment was a brigade. I didn't know the size. I didn't know the fine details that I wish I would have known. And I would have had more questions because that's what led to me kind of getting screwed over because I didn't necessarily know. I mean, he comes up one minute and he's like, well, all these are full, but this one's available. And I'm like, is that easy? Like, it just, I didn't know to ask certain questions. So he goes, all right, we'll get you an option 40 contract and blah, blah, blah. So I sign, get in the Army. Mom's not happy. But she could tell I was happy. I mean, I told her, I said, I got everything that I asked for, everything that I wanted, I got.
Real quick, bro. So when you got in, you pissed off Mama. Did you have to go? Is that when you went and told a UAB, look, you better find another tight end?
Yeah, I told them right before Christmas break in 97. Okay. I went up there and I scheduled a meeting with the coaches or whatever.
Got it.
And they were not happy, but they were okay with it. I mean, I gave them plenty of time. They had the whole winter and then into spring and all that. They had plenty of time to, and they did okay. I mean, okay. They told me what they did tell me. And it's the only thing that really made me stop and think. They said, well, there's no question if you're going to get re-signed. Literally, we have one more tight end who's basically not even on the travel team, really. So you're it. And so if you're worried about that and you want to, I said, that's not it. I just, you know, and it was comfortable because these guys, these coaches and these players went through the Dan thing with me, the like looking out for me. Watching out for me. So I did feel bad. But I knew the first time I get hurt or anything like that, I'm gonna be stuck like Chuck. So I just wanted to be proactive because
real quick, I'm sorry to cut you off.
No, go ahead.
For the people that are kind of tuning in and might have forgot, it's been a while since we did that episode. Dan was your mom's ex-boyfriend who put a gun to your damn chest or stomach and then ended up putting a gun on himself.
So
that was a bad situation. And you were in college at the time and your team was like, hey, dude, we got you.
Yep, that's right. He held me at gun. He was from Birmingham and I was going to school at UAB. Yeah. So he had said that he knew what dorms the football players live in. He knew where my room, all this stuff, knew where my room was. And I went to the head coach and said, look, here's the situation. This guy is doing all this stuff, which of course he would end up holding me at gunpoint for an hour and then going and burning my house down before he blew his brains out. But
at
this time, he was still hardcore stalking my mom and just trying to make her life miserable.
Right. Right.
They stood in and they were like, look, he's got to go through three floors of football players before he gets to your room. So you're good. So they looked out for me. But at the end of the day, what was right for me was to join the military. I hoped, I mean, Pat Tillman did it. He left. He gave up millions and millions of dollars just in the hopes of being an Army Ranger. You know, Pat Tillman left the NFL, gave up so many millions of dollars just to go to Ranger school. He could have failed. He could have not made it through Ranger school or something could have happened. So what I did is not as extreme as what he did. But it was a big decision and it turned out it was the right decision. But I get in, I got this option 40 contract and everything's floating. I get to basic training. I'm good. It's not that basic training wasn't hard. I mean, it was difficult, certain things. I was in the top shape of my life. I mean, I just come from playing ball. So I physically was a specimen. I mean, but, you know, dealing with knuckleheads and dealing with people yelling and screaming at you the way that took some getting used to. But I needed just to keep my mouth shut and don't say anything, because if you do, then you just make it worse. So I did that, and it took them a while to figure out how to break me down, because that's what a good drill sergeant figures out the ways to get to you.
Yeah.
They're going to figure out your weakness, and everybody's got one. And, you know, I was sitting there watching everybody else break and drop like flies and just had this hard time. And I was not affected.
What was your weakness at that time? Are you willing to share that with us?
Oh, I'm willing to share it. It's funny shit. about it, and this is probably basic training 16 weeks. So we're probably six or seven weeks into it. And like, I'm doing good. I'm run like in the platoon sergeant. I didn't just chill in the cut. I kept my mouth shut, but I didn't just blend in. I mean, if you're a natural leader, then that shows, that comes out. I mean, it even when you're not necessarily wanting it to. So there was things I noticed. They made me a platoon sergeant, squad leader, all this stuff. Well, one day I'm standing in line for the chow hall, and you know, you're nut to butt parade rest, and it's take a step forward back to parade rest, you know, in the chow line. And drill sergeant Taylor, who's about 5 foot tall, you know, little bitty fella, looks like Ratatouille. Walks up beside me, and I could feel this dude breathing on my arm. And I'm like, and it was right after PT, so we're in PTs. And I kind of look at him out of the corner of my eye. I'm like, what is this asshole got? His almost nose is like almost touching my arm. And he's like looking up at me. And I said, can I help you, drill sergeant? Like, what the fuck are you doing? He goes, why the fuck are you in the regular line? I said, huh? What does that mean? I didn't know there was another line. He said, you're a fat boy. I said, whoa, I'm a what? He said, you need to get in the fat boy line, fat ass. I was shocked. I didn't know what was going on. I'm like, what the fuck? So from that point on, this motherfucker, he said, you're overweight. You're what the Army calls obese. I'm like, I'm going to kill this motherfucker. I lost my shit. I was pissed off. I'm literally about to put my hands on this dude, and he's yelling at me. I said, I'm not getting in a fucking fat boy line. He's like, you go up. I mean, just he laid, and I had to stop myself. And I'm like, hold on, dude, you about to lose everything. And it took all that day, probably a day or two before it hit me. That motherfucker finally got me. He finally got me. All of everything they've been trying this whole time to find something, whatever it is to get to me, for some reason, that hit him in that moment, that day. Hey, let me go try this shit on Lloyd. And it worked. I mean, it worked like a charm. I was so pissed off. I was all discombobulated. I just didn't know what to do. But now once I realized it, I settled in. It sucked because I couldn't eat cake. They kept that shit going the whole time. They're like, "Yeah, Lloyd, you better get in that fat boy line. No cake for you."
Well, just to paint a picture, you just got done playing ball. You were a college athlete, and you were a tight end. So you're 6'2", 240, whatever, but you run fat.
Yeah, I had barely 6% body fat.
Yeah,
I had six-pack abs. I mean, it just – but here's the thing. By Army standards, I was overweight.
Well, yeah, but so are anybody that hits the gym. So that's why they had to tape your ass.
Yep, that's right. I always got taped, but on paper, it just says you're overweight. So he got away with it. I mean, he was
right.
He was exactly right. Yep. Fucking asshole.
So he got your goat.
But yes, and I did have a good conversation with him when I graduated. I was just like, man, no, I never knew that would have affected me that much. But I said, thank God I realized what you were doing, because had I not, I would have held a grudge and probably would have, my career probably wouldn't have went the way it ended up going, because I was going to choke his ass. I'm serious. I was so angry. You know how you say, man, I have killed people for a lot less. At that time, I hadn't, but still, I'd whooped a lot of ass, and I wasn't scared of him in any way. But it's just, that's kind of, if you look at it, that's just kind of just a props to him for not being scared. Because for all he knew, I could have grabbed him by his ankles and slammed him around that defect, broke some tables with him. But he did his job. He did really well, and it helped me. I mean, it opened the door and kind of opened me up and made me realize, dude, you're still human.
Yeah.
I mean, you got to deal with this shit too. And if I had not learned how to deal with that frustration and how to just suck it up and push forward regardless of what's being said or what's being done around you. I mean, that really helped me out. I mean, especially at a young age and coming off a college scholarship where, you know, at UAB in college, I mean, you just get treated different.
Yeah.
Whether it's right or wrong, I'm just saying, as a college athlete, you're just a different, not a different class of person, but you're held in such high regard, whether it's deserved or not. Most of the time it's not deserved, but it's whether it is or it's not, it still gets in your head.
Yeah.
And you still have that entitlement or whatever. And I like to think that I didn't walk around with that on my shoulder or acting like that, but I didn't have a lot of people, you know, I didn't have Drill Sergeant Taylors running around talking shit to me when I was in college. So it was definitely something that was needed and that helped me moving forward.
So his name was Sergeant Taylor, you said?
Yep. Staff Sergeant Taylor.
Staff Sergeant Taylor. Props to you, young man.
Yep. If you are out there somewhere, I ain't seen you since back then, but you were fucking ratatouille.
All right, man. So after that, how did boot camp? Let's boot camp go for you.
Yeah, it went really well. We had a drill sergeant come in that was new, and his name was Drill Sergeant Montgomery. He's the first person I ever knew with a Ranger tab. And him and I got really close. He was a big guy like me. He played football, I think, at a Division II school or maybe a junior college or whatever. And but him and I got along, and you could tell he was new because he would not hide the fact that he liked me. Like, he would just come up and start talking to me and shit, and the drill sergeants would have to pull him to the side and be like, "Hey, man, Montgomery, you can't do that. Like, you ain't talking to nobody else." But he was really cool, and him and I got along real well. And I let him know, you know, I got an option 40 contract, so I'm, you know, he told me about Ranger School, kind of helped me prepare what to work on. It just was a pretty cool thing. And by this point, the basic training's over, and we're into the AIT part, and where we're learning infantry tactics and all that stuff. So it is a little bit laid back more than it was anyway. But at the end of basic training, it comes up the, I was the honor graduate and I excelled, but you're sitting there, everybody's sitting, there's been a movies where they show it and it really happens like that, where you just sit down and the whoever's in charge has got a stack of paperwork with all the orders and they call your name and then they say where you're, you know, what duty station you're going to, and you get up and you run up there and grab your orders. Well, for most people, I think I was the only one that it wasn't a surprise. I was the only one that had enlisted with option 40 or anything that had a guaranteed duty station. So everybody else, it was kind of cool to see. They were surprised by it. Like, wow, I'm going here. And the majority of them were going to Fort Campbell, Kentucky to the 101st Airborne. And then they get to my name. It's alphabetical. They get to my name and he's like, Fort Campbell, Kentucky. And I said, oh, bullshit. What? Whoa. What are you talking about? And I went up there and I said, I'm supposed to stay here. I'm going to airborne school and into to Ranger Regiment. Like it was a contract. It's not. And of course, Drill Sergeant Montgomery, luckily he knew all about it. We had talked about it the whole time. So I walked over to him. He said, or he called me over or something. He said, let me see your orders. And he looked at them and he goes, let me handle it. I'll take it to the current, you know, up the chain of command or whatever and try to get it fixed. Well, next day or so I get called into the commander's office, the battalion commander. And I'm sitting down and he goes, I got bad news, man. You don't have an option 40 contract. And I said, what? He said, you don't. He said, you signed a contract, but he showed it to me. Sure enough, I just didn't read the fine print. I mean,
basically the recruiter, he didn't have one available. So he just gave you whatever without you knowing. I got you.
Yeah, because he knew I was going to walk out.
Yeah.
So he just made me think it was, and it happened a ton. Yeah. It happened a whole lot. Now I didn't know that, or I'd have read the fine print or looked a little bit more into it, but it was something that was, that happened a great deal, yeah. But it worked out the right way. I mean, I was pissed off. There's nothing I could do about it. But in my mind, at least I was going to the what made me okay was it, knowing at least I'm going to the 101st Airborne, which is a highly, you know, historically we, you know, it's just one of those, even I knew had heard of that. And so I knew the chances of me having an opportunity to go to Ranger school and all the stuff that I wanted to do and eventually go to Ranger Regiment, I knew that was going to be a possibility. Whereas if I'd have got stuck at Fort Hood in the fourth in mechanized or something like that, I'd have never even had a shot of anything like that. So I get to Fort Campbell and right off the bat, like the second day there, you're at a replacement company before they put you in your whatever unit you're going to, whatever infantry brigade. And two guys come up, one of them's named Michael Blaze, and the other one's, I can't remember his first name. His last name was Wadoski. They come up and give a briefing. And they were like, hey, we're from the Rockasans, baddest unit on earth, and we're the scout platoon. Basically, it was the recon battalion recon platoon, the scouts. Every infantry battalion has one. They're part of the headquarters company, and they do all the reconnaissance for the battalion, for the line companies. So they're kind of the specialty platoon. If you're going to, I mean, the closest thing that a unit like that has special ops, that's, you know, it's, they call it a specialty platoon. They have the sniper squad and all that. That's where the snipers are. But historically, they don't take dudes out of basic training. Like, you have to earn your spot in the scout platoon. So what they do is ever so often when they need to fill a spot, they do tryouts from guys that are seasoned in the line units, Alpha Bravo and Charlie Company, you know, the squad leaders, NCOs, whatever, guys with tabs, with Ranger tabs or whatever, they bring them in and give them a 30-day indoctrination to see if they'll take them. They just, taking somebody from basic training is just not something that they do. And they let us know they're going to give you this briefing, but we want you to know right off the bat, we have no intention of talking to any of you. We don't want to be here. We're checking a block. So don't ask us questions. Just let us give our spiel and get the hell out of here. Right. Well, I listened and I was like, holy shit, this is what I want to do. I mean, this is how I get to Ranger School. This is how I get all the stuff that I feel like I lost and was taken from me. This is how I make up for that, is going to be in that, being in that platoon. And so of course they told us absolutely not to ask questions, and nobody did except me. They turn around and walk off, and I caught up with them and was like, Hey, excuse me, let me ask you something. And they turn around and look at me, and they're like, fuck, he would, you know, I was too big for them to say, not just to turn around and walk away from. So they were like, well, I guess we'll give this big bastard his second and then tell him no. But that's what they did. They were like, we don't know. We don't take anybody from right out of basic training. It just don't happen. So get away from us, basically. And I said, look, you want me. And I kind of went through, I said, not 2 months ago, I was playing college football. I'm in the best shape of my life, blah, blah, blah. I go down this laundry list of things trying to sell myself. And they were like, huh. They looked at each other and like, you know what? We'll let you come to eval. You're in replacement. We'll take you, blah, blah, blah. And so I get down there, I guess a few days later, whenever I got my orders got assigned to the 1st Battalion, 187th Infantry Scout Platoon. And my 30 days of indoctrination and tryout turned into about 90. They tortured me for a long time and tried to get me to break, and I absolutely would not break. I mean, 12-mile runs, just torture, doing it's sniper thing called Kim's Games, where just brutal torture every day from the second you get downstairs into your what we call the tow room before formation around 5:30 every morning until 5:30 in the evening.
So it, Brandon, what is Kim's Games? Real quick, can you describe it?
Yeah, it's a game where it's for snipers. They'll put a just there's different ways to do it, but the way they did it was they take a wash rag or washcloth and put it in the middle of the floor in our little tow room, in our scout room, and they would put 10 items on it: a pencil eraser, a penny, a nail, anything, whatever. 10 small items that'll fit on this wash rag in the center of the room. Well, it was three of us that were going through this torture. So they take us outside, smoke the brains out of us, push-ups, sit-ups, running around the building, all kind of craziness, flutter kicks, you name it. Then they have us come inside. We walk into the room. The lights are off, and they turn the lights on, and they make us get in a like put our hands on the person in front of shoulders and literally run in a little circle around this wash rag looking down at it. And all they tell you is that pay attention to everything that's on that rag. But while they're doing it, they're saying, Lord, what's your social security number? Blah, blah, blah. They're distracting the hell out of you. You're already tired and smoked.
Yeah.
We didn't really know what was going on. So we're just looking at this wash rag, and I was putting it together like, okay, everything's on this thing for a reason. They're going to go back and ask us what this shit is eventually. So I'm just trying to take it in. And then they turn the lights. But I think it's 10, probably 20 seconds, 15, 20 seconds you do that. Then it's lights out, back outside, smoked for another half an hour. Then we come inside. You get a piece of paper, and it's numbered 1 through 10 down the left. And across the top, it's like height or it's item. Then a line, it's broke down in columns. So you got the item, and then you have the height and width, the size. Like you had to basically have all the details on each individual item that was on that wash rag. So like penny, you know, half a centimeter was the height, you know, half an inch wide, brown, you know, copper brown in color. So it was like that for every individual item that was on that thing.
Holy shit, man.
We did it numerous times, but that first time was the one that really mattered to me, and I got all 10 of them.
Damn, I'd have been like, hey, there's a rag on the floor. That's about as far as I would have got.
Well, You know, that is one thing that I did, though. I was the only one, too, that at the bottom put there were also the what they did. I'm glad you said that. They put 9 items on there. There's 10 things. The 10th rag. The rag, yeah. And nobody else got it. Nobody else got more than 3 items. I get it. I mean, that I was prepared for something. I had, by this point, I had been getting tortured. Ken's game's not as effective if you only have one person doing it. So I had to wait until a couple more guys come in to go through this indoctrination like I'm in before they did it. So, but it was fun. I mean, it definitely works your brain. And
well, Brandon, you must be a crazy bastard because it don't sound fun to me at all.
It's definitely not fun doing it that way. Yeah, when you know they added their own fun to it. On top of, you know, you go to the arms room and sign out a prick E6 or go to the combo shop and get a prick E6 radio playing all those.
Prick E6. In the Navy, we had something called an HT punch. And back in the day, you went down to engineering and the HT was usually a big old boy. You go down and say, yeah, I'm looking for an HT punch. And that son of a bitch would just smack you right as hard as it could in the heart. Or the channel fever shot, you go down to medical and they pull out this needle about 3 or 4 inches long. And they're like, here's a channel fever shot. They don't give it to you, but they make you look at it. Little fun fuck games they played in the Navy back in the day. Yeah.
Yeah. Get the keys to the back 40 or a box of grid squares.
Or batteries for the sound powered phones.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's always a good one. Okay, man. So you definitely kicked ass in this indoctrination, especially if you can name all 10 items, including the damn rag on the floor. So what happens after that?
Well, once I kind of was in the mix, I mean, I had great leadership, man. That's what made me. That's what made my career. That's what made everything that would come after this first duty station and this first assignment as a scout. The leaders I had there completely set me up for success in every way. That's when I learned and lived by. Shut up, listen, and emulate. Shut up, listen, emulate. Just, and then I break it down even more. Is just shut up and don't talk when you shouldn't be talking because you'll miss something. And listen, but listen. I had to learn to listen to the right people. You can listen to everybody, but pay attention to the words from the, because you, not all leaders are great. Not all leaders do it the right way. You have to learn to know which ones to follow, and then emulate. That's all for me to carry on and take bits and pieces from these guys and then add my own mix to it and add my own leadership style and things here and there to what they had already taught me. I carried them with me the entire rest of my career. In fact, Michael Blaze, that first dude that come in there and basically said, we told you not to ask us questions, bonehead. Like that hit my daughter's named after him. My daughter's name is Presley Blaze. So that's how much of an impact he had on me. He was killed in Iraq. He just a great dude and good leader. So I just wanted to start with that because there's nothing that I've ever done, nothing I've ever accomplished that don't have the fingerprints of so many other people on it. It's like I was self-taught in a lot of things, but I had to know certain things to be able to teach myself certain things. So, you know, nothing was all me that's the unfortunate thing these days is if you get a bad leader, especially early in your career, it can really warp you and really mess up a kid who has a lot of potential. And I never wanted to be that guy. So I had good examples and I would end up going to sniper school. I knew I could shoot pretty good. And I went to the special operations target interdiction course, which is done by Still Special Forces group at Fort Campbell. That's the first one I went to. I went to air assaults, all these schools, and it was working. Like, I realized, damn, the decisions I've made and the choice, even after getting derailed and losing my Ranger contract, getting here and this working out and them guys showing up, giving me an opportunity to come down here. It was all working out, but it was still up to me to keep my ass in shape, to keep my ass one step ahead of the game, because at all times you're getting you're not only getting evaluated during that 60 day, whatever it was during that indoctrination, you're getting evaluated every single day. Yeah. And if you don't make, if you're not good enough, they'll kick you down to a line unit and replace you very easily. So knowing that, it just pushed me and made me push myself that much harder, because I love that job. I mean, being on a sniper team and getting to make your ghillie suit and going to, the field sucked. The job sucked. It you know, horrible conditions, being miserable. But the payoff, it was always the coolest thing. I mean, you can look back on it and say, damn, I'm a fucking sniper in the the 100th Airborne Division.
Right. So after all the training, after you got through that training, that hell, and then you went to follow on school, so you became a sniper scout. Is that right?
Yeah. The scout sniper, they have a squad that is three snipers and three spotters. And like, it's really, keep it simple, stupid. If it's broke down, the sniper, you have three of them for each company, Alpha, Bravo, and Charlie company.
Okay.
Your battalion. So, you don't have a squad on your own. You do fall into a squad and you're part of the sniper squad, but it's basically three squads in a scout platoon. Each squad has a sniper and a spotter. So first squad does their reconnaissance and their sniper operations for Alpha Company. Second squad does them for Bravo Company. Third squad, Charlie Company. Every time we go to the field, when I was in third squad, so every time we went to the field, our reconnaissance operations and going and getting eyes on an objective, we come back and we talk to Charlie Company, then they go assault that objective based on the intel that we got them. And if they need overwatch or a sniper operation or sniper team, then we do it for them, for Charlie Company. And it was really cool. It was, it worked. And then Kosovo comes up.
Yeah. I saw them getting to Kosovo. So a scout sniper or sniper scout, however you say it, at that time?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
We deployed to Kosovo, and that was a weird operation. I say weird. For me, at that time, that was my first deployment, so I didn't really know what weird was and what weird wasn't. I knew they called it it was a bombing campaign, and we were over there early enough that there was still shit blowing up, and they would use the sniper teams. They used us so many different ways, lasing targets for aircraft to blow up things, overwatch, just intel gathering, because we were in a weird spot as peacekeepers. We still had NATO that was there. And, it was odd. It was different. I enjoyed it. I learned a lot, did a lot of dismounted patrols through towns, got to, learn a lot of different things about the cultures over there. Really cool. But then the sniper operations were definitely difficult when you go out for 3 or 4 days at a time, just you and one other person. That always sucks, because you walk.
So you're out there sleeping where you're sitting, and you're not coming back for the benefits.
It wasn't the sniper operations that we would turn to end up doing, like in Iraq and Afghanistan, and urban environment type stuff. We would do them that way, but it was more of an overwatch, intel gathering type things. But on an actual sniper mission, you get dropped off at an LZ, and you're going to walk a long damn way to get to wherever you're going. And then you're going to, when it's over and you pull out, you got to walk a long damn way to get to wherever the extraction point is.
Right.
Right. So, but I will say my entire career is 17 years. That's the only time that I actually did my job by the book. Like everything that I was trained to do, the stuff that I was supposed to do by the numbers, that's where I did it. I got to do it in Kosovo. So that was a cool thing. I mean, it was everything that you're prepared for, that you trained for, you get to go put it into action in a combat situation. So that was cool. And it was not as, you know, what we would come to find in Iraq and Afghanistan. It wasn't necessarily dangerous, but it was. I mean, there was always a chance of things getting out of control because you're putting yourself in the middle of two it was the Serbs and the Albanians. You're putting yourself in the middle of these two, and the sense of just like the Shia and the Sunni or whatever, you know, since the beginning of time, these people, they have hated each other. So you're making yourself a target by inserting yourself into that situation.
Because you're in the middle of the action. I mean, they could be firing on each other and you're collateral damage. Is that what you're getting at?
That's exactly right. And so for the most part, it worked out okay. It worked out good, but it's just still the stress level was there, especially, you know, the riots and the amount of craziness. I got hit in the face with a rock one time, had to end up getting stitches inside of my mouth. And I shot the dude with a non-lethal, a damn out of my 203. I put one of those ones. It's got three of these like hard rubber balls that that are really packed inside this 30 millimeter grenade canister thing. So when they come out, they're like, and they kind of swirl. Well, I'm trying to get, there's 200 people on this bridge who this guy named Pope of Dragon is what we called him. He was a Catholic priest who we won't get into the end, where he would end up. But he incited a riot and there's hundreds of people on this bridge. We're trying to get him off the bridge. And the next thing I know, I'm picking myself up off the ground, spitting up blood. And I look down off this bridge and I was not over the water yet. I was still, you know, 15 foot from this guy, but he's on the grass right down below me. He had thrown this big ass rock up and hit me right in the side of my face. And I was like, oh, it's over for you, buddy. He turned around. I pointed at him because they knew our rules of engagement. They knew what line they could cross that was going to make us lock and load rounds. They just knew. Well, when he saw me, he was like, oh, shit. I pointed that 203 at him. He turned around and hauled ass. And I put, man, boom, I shot him. Shot that non-lethal, and it comes out swirling, and he caught his ass right in the middle of his back. Broke a rib, and I went down there, and we started working on him. Like, you know, he wasn't life-threatening. He was in a lot of pain, but so was I.
Yeah, right.
We put him in our Humvee and take him back to Camp Bondsteel so they can look at him, and they look at me and put some stitches in my mouth. And then 2 days later, I get called into the commander's office and they take me to see the general, whatever general it was at the time in charge. They ended up, long story short, giving me a damn article, summarized Article 15 for firing non-lethal rounds without
Brandon, real quick, for those that don't know that's listening, Article 15 is basically a non-judicial punishment given by the commander or the general or the Navy, the admiral or the captain of a unit or command. So yeah, so basically you're in deep shit.
Yeah, I got in trouble for shooting non-lethal rounds. Basically, had I shot him with a bullet, I could have got away with it because he hit me. Like he hit me with a rock in the face and drew blood on me.
Rules and of engagement, don't fire until fired upon, right?
Yeah, my reaction to that was I had non-lethal rounds. I wasn't going to kill the guy. I didn't, you know, there's no telling what that would have caused.
Right.
You know, the backlash, and I knew that. So non-lethal though. I mean, we had them. What the hell is non-lethal? Yeah. It's just letting this dude know, don't ever do that again. That was the wrong move. And I would have never thought I would have gotten in trouble, but they just wanted you to go through this process to call your higher command and then let it go up the chain of command, requesting permission to use non-lethal. I wasn't going through that. I'm bleeding right now.
Yeah.
This dude, and he's not getting away.
Right.
I mean, I'm finna solve this problem right quick. And I did, and I paid for it. I didn't lose my, because they can take up to one rank and half of your pay and all that garbage. They didn't do that. They basically just, that general told me that he was using me as an example, because he wanted people to know how serious the situation was. And if you cross a line, we could make our own situation even worse. And I said, well, I don't think using me in that situation that just happened, I don't think using that is the right example.
Right.
You're telling dudes that they get hit in the face and they're bleeding that there's no recourse. There's plenty of other idiots out there drinking and doing silliness. It's all kind of silly shit. Use them as an example. Find one of them that's drunk or whatever on guard duty in the tower.
Right.
And use one of them.
Slam their ass, but don't slam a guy that's behind enemy lines doing his job.
Yeah, and the only reason I did is because it was not necessarily too high profile, but it was, people knew it happened. That's what it was. I mean, it just, word of me shooting that guy with that non-lethal just got out and got around, and instead of protecting me, they covered their own ass and punished. But, like my sergeant major used to tell me, man, Article 15 is just build character.
That's all. That's it, man.
That wouldn't be my, that was not, that was my first one, but it was not my last.
Cool. So Coastal went down. Yeah, it was around 99, correct?
Yep, 99 into 2000.
So let's fast forward. Let's talk about your Ranger tab. You do have a Ranger tab, or you did when you were active.
Mm-hmm.
How did that happen? Because you went from basically kind of getting the business, joining, going straight infantry, got blessed with these guys you met and worked your ass off, became a sniper scout. So after Kosovo, did you pursue your Ranger?
Oh, no. Well, it was before then.
Oh, it was? Okay.
Yeah, I went in 99. And Kosovo wasn't until the end of 2000, I think, or end of 99 into 2000 is when they did the bombing campaign.
Right.
So I went, that was the goal the entire time. The thing about being in the 101st at Fort Campbell and trying to do something like that, something that's such a difficult thing, is you're representing, I got the Screaming Eagle patch on my arm, so I'm representing the 101st Airborne.
Right.
Not going to send you to a school, like they're going to send you to any school, but especially that type of school, unless they know 100% for a fact that you're coming back with a Ranger tab. Like, you're not going to embarrass them and fail,
right?
Or do something stupid and get kicked out, whatever the case is. So they set up all the posts that send. Now, I'll say this too, back then, completely different now, but back then you had to be an 11 Bravo to go to Ranger school. It was only for infantry guys, unless you were already in Ranger regiment, then I think they would send their support guys or whatever, I think,
back then.
But as far as guys that were in other posts around the Army, you had to be an 11 Bravo. It was what it was. So now they slowly started to let in other MOSs, but it's just a good school in so many different ways. But anyway, they set up a what's called pre-Ranger, which I guess would kind of mirror RIP or RASP, the Ranger Assessment and Selection. That's what it's kind of set up to be. Pre-Ranger is, I think when I went, it was 13 or 14 days. But they pack most of, they don't necessarily get into the too much of the tactics, but they kind of let you, it's also, you can't say it's a refresher, and it's not to get you ready for Ranger school in any way.
Okay.
You should be ready by the time you get to pre-ranger. They're just making sure that you're good to go and squared away and everything's going to be smooth sailing when you get to Fort Benning. Like, you don't make a decision on ranger school based off how good you do in pre-ranger. It's just, it ain't like that, because it was miserable. It was extremely hard. They packed ranger school 62, 63 days. They pack it all into 13 days. And, I was fortunate. I did all that hard stuff. I did a lot of it young. So I had learned my way of doing things. I hadn't learned the wrong way, typically. My expert infantry badge and all these things that I got early in my career, it's because I had good leadership and I had not been out there on my own in the field learning how to do B-Lloyd's way.
So you didn't learn bad habits yet.
No, I still had that field manual step-by-step way of doing it in my head. You get out and start doing things, and the longer your career goes on and as you move forward, you learn ways to do things better or to do things differently, but you're taught one way. So that was a big part of my success too, was it was done early. So I didn't have any bad habits or anything established yet. So go to pre-ranger and then you have a weekend off. I graduated pre-ranger on a Friday. Then the following Monday, I was reporting to Fort Benning. All that stuff, man, the first few years of my career doing this book has kind of helped me refresh some of my memories. But I don't remember a whole lot of stuff. I remember how much, that I learned a lot and how much it would establish. It just kind of made me more aware of I was in the right place. Like this whole military thing is where I need to be. And I don't know, I was just hitting on all cylinders all the time, ready to rock and roll.
Would you say that when you went to Fort Benning, your no shit Ranger course, right? Would you say that was in peacetime the most challenging thing you've ever done in the Army in peacetime?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, by far. But it's just like other stuff. Everybody's on a different journey. Everybody comes from a different place. So when you go through a course like that, that is so physical, it is very physical, but it's also so mental, and they're sleep depriving you, malnourished, all these things play into it. So how you get through it and how much you suffer during those times is based on a lot of factors. Like I was still in perfect shape. I had my 5 mile run down. Like there was nothing, I did not suffer physically like a lot of guys did. It was not easy. Don't take that the wrong way. It wasn't easy, but, how many guys that was stressed out so much about the run or about, the big 5 mile or whatever it was, they're so stressed out about certain things that it didn't allow them to focus on whatever it was that they were something else that might be difficult.
Yeah.
Me being in the physical shape I was in. I never stressed one time about that part. So I was able to shift focus and think about, okay, I'm losing weight. I didn't lose it fast like a lot of guys. I ended up losing 20 pounds, but it just allowed me to make sure you do this thing right. So I wasn't hyper-focused on something that I was worried I was going to fail and meanwhile getting distracted from something that would end up making me fail, which is
it seemed to me like you were kind of, since you weren't worried about the physical part, it was tough, but you had it. You were more worried about the damn, like the fine details.
Yeah. Making sure that I didn't get peered out, making sure I wasn't an asshole. Yeah. If I got in the leadership spot or when I was not in the leadership spot, making sure I was carrying my weight and helping and doing as much as I could, because I knew I would eventually be in a leadership spot where I was going to need dudes to work for me. But that was what it was. I mean, how many guys I didn't know, because I'd been to air assault school. I had done some stuff that had heights involved. But then the water survival training, that was one of the ones that kind of out of nowhere got me, scared me a little bit. Not worried about failing, but it was mainly watching all the other guys go before me and start treading water and then just quit. I mean, dudes was just like, fuck this.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what is it? How can it be that bad? But that was where my mind just, I could, until I did it, until I climbed this ladder way the hell up. And then you walk across this plank that's got the Ranger tab in the middle of it, these steps you have to step over. And then you catch a zip line at the end, you zip down, you have to, or not, excuse me, you don't zip down, you climb out, you grab this cable, you climb all the way out to the middle of it where there's a Ranger tab, and you touch it, and then you drop way down 30 or 40 foot into the water. Yep. It's up there. But then when you hit the water, now you got to tread water for 5 minutes. Yep. And it's extremely cold water. And I was kind of freaking out a little bit. And then remembering, man, now I see why all those guys quit. Like, this sucks. But of course I didn't quit. It's just the anxiety will start building up, and you have to you have to be conscious enough and self-aware enough to calm yourself down a little bit.
So before we move on, how long was Ranger school? Do you remember?
I think when I was 62 days, and you average probably, they like to say you average one meal a day, which is one MRE.
Yeah,
it's enough food for a day.
Right.
You get one MRE and your average an hour or two of sleep a night. Now, some nights you'll get four, some nights you'll get zero.
Yeah.
And then you're doing your movement to daylight operations and all that stuff. I mean, in the mountains in Dahlonega, during the mountain phase, you do your mountaineering and all that stuff. Then you go to transition to Florida down to Eglin Air Force Base and do the swamp phase.
Yeah. That's a good spot to do it.
It is. Yeah. It definitely is miserable. Oh my gosh. How miserable was that in September?
So, man, in those few years, you went through boot camp, you did your advanced infantry training, AIT.
Yeah.
You became a sniper scout, and then you became a ranger in those before 2000.
Yeah, thinking my whole life is just set up. I'm going to be an infantry guy till I die. Yeah. I thought I had it all figured out. And then
something happened. We call it nowadays 9/11.
Yeah. And the crazy way it would play out for me was the military was what I was supposed to be doing, especially when I started getting a little bit of rank and moving up and noticing and recognizing my ability to lead and my ability to get guys to want to follow me. When I noticed all that, I wasn't going anywhere, but I also knew I've done this. I've checked all my blocks as an infantry guy. I mean, anything that I wanted to do, I've done it. You know, I didn't get to regiment. That's okay. And that was still a goal. So what it come up on reenlistment. And I said, the thing is, I don't want to get out now, but
so you reenlisted before 9/11, correct?
Yeah. Before 9/11.
Yeah.
Because my time was coming, and I'd already done everything. It's not that there was nothing left for me. I just, the blocks I checked, Ranger school, sniper school, blah, 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 I had done them. But I also knew that one day I might want to get out. It might be after this next trip. I don't know. But the skills that I have now are not going to translate to the outside world.
Right.
So I wanted to take everything that I had at that point and take it into another job. And just be better at that job, whatever that job is. So I went to the reenlistment guy and went down, sat down over discussing things. And in my mind, the only thing that was going to get me to Ranger Regiment and back to the infantry world, because I didn't want to leave that world. And there's only a certain amount of jobs. In fact, the only person that is on inside an infantry platoon and goes on patrols with them and all, other than the infantry guys, is a medic. They all got a medic. So I was like, you know, I got this tab. I can go to the special or the Ranger medic course or the special operations medic course. And already with a tab already, I get all this medical stuff done. Then I'm a guarantee to be accepted into regiment in my mind. Of course, I don't know how that would have went, but that was my mindset. It's like, I was still taking steps towards going to that, to regiment and being in that world. That's what I did. I was going to reenlist to be a combat medic. Then I would have left Fort Campbell, went to Fort Sam Houston to do the combat medic course. And then you go to Fort Bragg to do the special operations combat medic course. And the problem with all of it was I reenlisted about 4 o'clock one afternoon. It was September the 10th. And then the next day, everything changed. And I was like, are you serious? Did I seriously just reenlist as a medic the day before everything happens? I was so angry, so mad at my decisions. Cause now, I mean, I had just undone everything. Like, the real war is going to happen. We didn't know, but we knew somebody's going to kill bad guys somewhere.
Yeah.
Do that. And the 101st is guaranteed one of them. So knowing that, I went and asked them, please, can you tear this up? Just act like that didn't happen. Because y'all spent millions of dollars training me to do all the things I've done. Surely you want to take me as a package to war with you. You're like, come on, man. I'm trying to convince them. And they're like, nah. You will go into war, but you're going to Fort Sam Houston, Texas, to be a medic. And that's exactly what happened. It wouldn't take me long to realize that the good Lord's plan was working out. It had nothing to do. Yeah. You know, it's my skin, and my body, but somebody else has got the remote control. Right. And I was supposed to be where I was. I don't know. Looking back on it, I just am fortunate and happy that my mindfulness and the things that I'd learned from my leaders, that they set me up for success. Like I said, I mean, I would hit sticking points like that and rough decisions. I went to Fort Sam. I was not happy. I wasn't doing good in classes. Medical crap's hard, but I wasn't doing good because I was pissed. I didn't want to be there. My dudes by that point, you know, they're in Afghanistan fighting.
Yeah.
And I'm stuck here. So, I mean,
I bet your mom was happy though.
Yeah, I'm sure. about a month or two into it, and I ain't going to go too much in detail on this because it upsets me, but the squad that I was in, the helicopter Operation Anaconda happens, helicopter gets shot down, and a lot of dudes that I know died.
Yeah.
And I get the word of that. And I just remember thinking that was a kind of a turning point or a decision-making point for me where I could have let that make it worse and been pissed off even more that I was there and not with them. Or what I decided to do was say, you know what? I know now that I was not there because I was supposed to be here. So I can't be upset that I would probably be dead if I were there. So being mad about not being there is ridiculous.
Yeah.
So what you need to do is buckle down and learn everything you can learn so you can be the best medic this military's ever seen. So if you're ever in the situation with that where that helicopter goes down, you know exactly how to react and how to help those dudes and save lives. And that's that's the route that I took. And it worked out for me and for a lot of other people who are alive to this day. I lost a lot of dudes, but
yeah,
you have to force yourself to remember you didn't lose everybody. You know, just our brains are wired to think of the worst things and those, the guys that we didn't say, that's always the first in our mind, but, and that's okay. As long as you don't forget to remember all those ones that you did save. Cause there's countless guys like that out there. Guys still walking, still breathing, still with families. Because I had the opportunity to work on them. And it's just one of them things. I've had a lot of pride and a lot of honor in being able to do things like that.
So, but you after all that, you buckled down, got through medical school, got through.
Well, yeah, got through all that. And then if I don't have it written down on a timeline, but because at this point, when I get done, wrap up everything, it's we're pushing into the end of 2002 now.
Yeah.
And Iraq is coming. So the Ranger battalions have been deploying back and forth to Afghanistan. And so when I'm getting ready to leave Fort Bragg, there was nobody at Fort Benning or in Hunter Army Airfield. The Ranger Regiment was kind of split and spread all over. And at that point, my goal was to get to war, not the Ranger Regiment. Or, you know, I could set shit up later. My job now is to find somebody that's going to take me to kill bad guys or heal somebody, whatever it is. Which that led me back to eventually back to Fort Campbell, Kentucky, in the 101st Airborne. And then the way I thought that was going to play out was I get there and go to 5th Group because I'm only a few months shy of the 18 Delta. I could go back and finish.
5th Group, so everybody knows, that's out there in the Persian Gulf area, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's 5th Fleet. We call it the Navy, 5th Group in the Army. Go ahead.
5th Special Forces Group. They're based out of Fort Campbell. And 18 Delta is the Special Forces medical sergeant. And I was, once you do the Special Operations Medic course, you're a little over halfway done with that 18 Delta course. So when I got back, when they sent me back to Fort Campbell, I was thinking maybe this is another sign of that I need to notice, because I'm back here now. I can go to 5th Group and get a SFAS Special Forces Assessment and Selection date. And then just go finish the 18 Delta course and be a Green Beret. Did not want to do that. That was not a goal of mine. That was not a world I wanted to go into, but it was just, that was the thought process, still trying to figure out and better myself for the future. But that didn't work out. I ended up in the 506th. They brought the 506th back, which is Kerr He from the Band of Brothers HBO show.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of getting ahead of myself now, because that was by that point that was the second deployment. Here we go. I skipped over a whole damn thing. The first place I went was, I got on the phone with my branch and said, I want to know who's deploying next. Like, who's going to wherever we're going next? And by this point, it is pushing, I want to say January of 2003. So by this point, people knew we were going to Iraq. And they sent me to Fort Hood. I didn't have much of a choice. I just, they answered my questions and sent me where I wanted to be sent in a lot of ways. I just didn't really know what I was asking for, which was kind of my ignorance. But I ended up in 4th Infantry Division, mechanized, and hell on earth for a dude like me that's walked everywhere, either helicopter or walk. And now I got all these track vehicles and shit. I was like, nope, I can't do this. But I mean, I deployed. That's, they take the tank. That's who goes to the desert, the big track vehicles and all. So that was a surefire way, and they were getting ready to deploy. So I did, and I was the senior line medic for Charlie Company, 1st Battalion, 22nd Infantry. And that's kind of the how it would go. I went with them. I was that was my or what we call organic unit. I was assigned to them, and which of course we won't get into much of this part. But shortly after getting to Kuwait, and not long before we crossed the berm and start the invasion of Iraq, I would end up getting attached to another group, which is part of Task Force 20 at the time. And it would end up Task Force 121, which is just a mix of Tier 1 and Special Operations guys from JSOC, Joint Special Operations Command.
And they had one objective.
Finding Saddam.
Yeah. Yep. It's funny. Yeah, we'll save that for another episode. But it's funny how you were kind of sought out for that medic position, kind of, right?
Yeah, not even knowing it. I still don't really know how that come to be. I know that I would come to hate the term medic with a tab.
Yeah.
I didn't like that at all. It didn't bother me at first, but then it just got to be a little crazy. But because you have to remember when as a new medic, I was a prior entry guy, and I did use a lot of those skills to train my dudes, train my medics, and I gave them a lot of training. They wouldn't have gotten other and had they not had me there. but when you get rank and now, you know, I'm an E5, E6, trying to have guys follow me and I'm their leader. I'm a lot of things to these guys, their mama, their daddy, their everything, babysitter, all of it is what we do as leaders. I didn't want them looking at anything that was on my uniform and respecting that and not listening to me. So I wanted to establish myself as a senior medical guy.
Right.
And it's hard when the tab stuff gets thrown in there, because at the end of the day, that tab has never saved anybody. It's never started the IV line or put a tourniquet on anybody. The medical side of me has, though. So it's just one of those things that it was a conflict in me. It was a personal thing that while, yes, I have these skills that I learned, that my primary objective is to be a medical guy and then train other guys to be medical guys. So that's how it worked out. I mean, the invasion of Iraq, that was a crazy, crazy time, dude. Nuts to invade a country where the Garden of Eden was, you know, just the historical aspect of it. And I was a big history guy, so I read the history of that part of the world, and you know, the Babylon, just all of it. But I was also, because of that, kind of scared too, thinking, oh shit, I hope the world don't end while I'm here. Uh-huh. Like, this has got all the signs of what you read in Revelations.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true. You got through that. Saddam's called, as we know, and the history tells us. So you still had several years of combat ahead of you. You didn't even know it yet.
Oh, I didn't know it. Yeah. We did Operation Red Dawn. We caught a guy, Ibrahim Al-Mushlet, Saddam's inner circle guys. Uh-huh. Interrogated him, got enough actionable intelligence to where we were able to put together a plan to go find Saddam. And of course, we looked for him daily, and of course, had never found him. A lot of empty holes, a lot of bull, a lot of garbage, a lot of frustration. A lot of things that seemed like it was good intel, but at the end of the day, it wasn't. Operation Red Dawn, it just seemed like there was just something a little different to it. Seemed like the certain pieces were working. You know, some of the special operations guys, the interpreter, I can't remember his name, but he was the linguist that they brought in. So many people played a extremely important part and things coming together the way it did, and not necessarily together. They kind of in different areas, different parts, they were focusing on theirs, whatever their expertise was, and it all come together, and we would end up finding him because of it.
It's just how it works, man. Everybody in the military has their little piece of the pie, if you will. And when that pie comes together, you know, great shit happens, magic happens, and you meet your objective, which y'all did. Y'all caught the bastard. And I'm going to say this, no matter how people felt about that invasion, there's a lot of people that was against it, a lot of people that was for it, but nobody can deny Saddam Hussein was not a good guy.
He was the most evil man on the planet of our generation, for sure.
Yeah, he's up there with Hitler.
And to see him coming out of a hole in the ground, talking about I'm Saddam Hussein, the president of Iraq, and I'm willing to negotiate. You talking about something that's just a surreal, wow, whoa.
Wow.
And then, of course, we had the target objectives were Wolverine. We had two of them right on the Tigris. One of them was a kind of farmhouse, and Wolverine 1 and Wolverine 2. And we had two teams, one team hit each place, and both of them were empty, actually. But doing a little bit more searching around this farmhouse and pushing these two knuckleheads a little bit further, and the questions we were asking had them, they led us to where an area we should be in, and they didn't point out the hole, but they kind of directed us to it, and we got over there, and that's where it was. That was
it was a great operation, successful operations.
Yeah. And then I got transitioned back to the headquarters where they the General Ray Odierno and all the other higher ups, Colonel Vale, Colonel Russell, who was my battalion commander. They were in a room deciding on how they're going to approach this, how they're going to release the information to the public, and what's the next steps for where he goes. And I'm across the hall doing a medical exam on him.
Yeah.
Spending 45 minutes in a room with that madman.
Was he crazy?
He was crazy for damn sure.
So we all know that how that ends. You know, he swings from a rope.
Yes, that's exactly right. He did. And I was there too, doing the security on the courthouse area.
Wow. That's crazy. That's major part of our generation's history right there.
Yeah. And it's crazy. It's still hard for me to wrap my mind around it sometimes, that I was the part that I did play in it.
Yeah, definitely. Hell yeah. So how did that set up the rest of your time? And that whole Afghani, you know, war on terrorism.
Yeah, we spent, I guess, a total of 14 or 15 months there. And we got back. So I was stationed at Fort Hood, mechanized, right? But lucky for me, because of this getting attached to this special operations or the JSOC task force and all that, I didn't have to spend time working on Bradleys and track vehicles and all that garbage, thank goodness. And then when we got back to Fort Hood, I immediately got on the phone with my branch manager and was like, I gotta get the hell out of here. Y'all can't do this to me. Like, I'm gonna end up leaving and going AWOL if you don't send me somewhere, some light infantry somewhere. And they were like, well, it looks like you were at the 101st at Fort Campbell for quite some time. There's a slot available there because they're standing up the 506 again. And I was like, hell yes. When can I go? So a year and a half, a little over a year and a half, I was stationed there at Fort Hood with the 1st Battalion, 22nd Infantry. I was actually there just a handful of months. 2 months before the deployment, before Iraq, and 2 months after Iraq, and I was gone and happy about it too. I was
get
back to them, to the Black Hawks and the soles of my shoes being my transportation. So we get get back to Fort Campbell, and I end up one of the first, I think, first 50 dudes in this brigade. They stood up the 506. First, they had first and second battalion 506, and then they had a new thing going. It was the new restructured, remodulizing the army. Each brigade wanted it to be self-sustaining in combat, so they had these kind of created these task force where instead of having to deploy a whole division to have all the assets, you had to deploy a whole division. And instead of doing that, they wanted to break it down and kind of make these brigade task force three individual self-sustaining mini divisions, basically. So each brigade combat team had air assets, all the assets that you would typically need the division level to get. We had it at brigade level, and they call them the brigade combat teams. So they were standing up the 506 as the fourth brigade combat team of the 101st, and they had the two infantry battalions, and then they had a cavalry. It was weird. They called it a RISTA, RSTA, Recon Surveillance and Target Acquisition unit. So it was basically you have CAV scouts, which are scouts that have vehicles back in the day, rode horses. And then you have what I used to be was a light infantry scout, which walks. This unit, this new RISTA, took the best of each and put it in one squadron. So they had two troops of CAV scouts, Alpha and Bravo troop of the cavalry scouts, and then Charlie Company, which was an entire infantry company of scouts. Whereas before it had only been a platoon level. So now they're able to use that like I was for the company level or for the battalion level, our scout platoon. Remember, I broke it down into squads. First squad. Well, now they kind of expanded this and we have this whole company or whole squadron that has a whole freaking company of scouts. So each company or each platoon has a battalion they're responsible for. So it was really crazy. It made a lot of sense to me because of my background. A lot of other guys, especially the medical guy, they couldn't wrap their heads around the shit. But because of my knowledge of scouts and how they operate and all that, it really worked out for me because I was one of the first 50 guys there. In fact, I was the first sergeant for the headquarters company when I first got there because they were literally filling this unit up. It was from zero. But then when you get the scout to the medical platoon, it's never been a risk to battalion medical platoon before. So we didn't have a SOP. We didn't have a tactical SOP. We didn't have any of that shit. So we had to create it all. So me and my good buddy, Ryan Myers, were able to sit down and we completely, which they still use it to this day. They did phase out the RISTA. They phased out a lot of stuff after the wars kind of dwindled down, but they worked really well. And so we wrote a entire, standard operating procedures for the medical platoon for a RISTA battalion, all kinds of hard work, but cool stuff.
Yeah.
Look back on and say, man, I had a big hand in operations and the tactical and technical side of putting this unit together. And I always say to your legacy is not because a lot of people remember your name necessarily. A legacy to me is doing things a certain way and training guys to do things a certain way that turns into something that 100 years from now, there's somebody that's still teaching somebody, their dudes, how to do shit the way that I taught how to do it.
Right.
That's how you leave a legacy. You ain't got your names not attached to it. It's just, you know, just leading by example and doing things a certain way that it's long after you're gone, some of the things that you created are still in place.
Right, right. Your practices are still there. Maybe not your name, but your practices.
Yep. And that's what matters at the end of the day.
Yep.
You where was I at? Did I get stuck?
No, you were talking about how everything lead up through the rest of your
Are we working good on time?
I got my maybe 30 minutes.
Okay. I can get to it. So at this point,
go ahead. So basically I just wanted to kind of follow up. So basically, like we talked about, your name's not attached to any of this shit that people are doing now. It's the way you do business, the way you did business, carried on because it was the right way to do business. It was the Army way. It made sense. And for that, it's carrying on to this very day. You know, what? When did you retire? 2015? So you're talking going on 18 years later, it's still being carried on. Now, that whole time after the 03 capture of Saddam Hussein, you had a lot of shit go down with you in those years following that until your retirement or until you were done overseas.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you had a bounty on your head. You had to watch friends die as you worked on them. I mean, let's get into that, man, because that's some heart-wrenching shit.
Yeah. They stood up the 506. And from the day I got there, we knew within a year, even though, I mean, we had 50 dudes in an entire brigade, which is, well, you know, that's a few thousand in a brigade or a regiment. We had 50 dudes, but we knew within a year, we're going to be deploying. We're going to be back in Iraq. So when I get to the establishing these SOPs and in this medical platoon and all, I'm getting these new guys fresh out of freaking training, and you know, they were at their senior prom months before. Now I got to teach these guys how to be able to sustain and take care of an entire infantry platoon. Just so many things that we had to teach them fast. It's really fast, and be comfortable with it. And we just didn't have a lot of time. So we stood up this unit, and within a year, we were gone. Now, what happened right before my next deployment, which was 05, Hurricane Katrina happened.
Yep.
And I went on emergency leave and come down here and brought I brought my boat and a lot of gas, a lot of fuel, did all kind of stuff. I worked on a search and rescue team, going and pulling bodies out of houses. That was kind of rough because I wasn't never expecting to do that in my home, my own country. But I got back.
Your own home area where you grew up.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Well, we get that was September. So at the end of September, I get back to Fort Campbell. I think I was home for 2 or 3 weeks. And got back to Fort Campbell, and by November the 1st, we were deployed, and we were going to back in Kuwait. Now I'm more comfortable with my dual role at this point because of the leaders I had at this point. Plus, I had more rank. I'm a staff sergeant, senior staff sergeant. I have more decision and more leeway for what I can and don't do.
Right.
So we get to get established. This time we're in East Baghdad, and I run basically you have a treatment section and an evac section in a medical platoon, and I was in charge of the evac section, and then all the line medics, which were the dudes that one per infantry platoon, each of them had a medic. And we had to have a medic on every patrol. Every time somebody, you know, they rolled out the gate, every patrol had to have a medic on it. So I was in charge of putting all these medics there, all the training and all that stuff. And I was also used to, as a the NCOIC or non-commissioned officer in charge of one of our other combat QRF for a while, the Quick Reaction Force. And then the TAC, Tactical Action Center, which is, we were on the streets 18 hours a day, man. Just meeting with local sheiks, just mayors, just trying to get the lay of the land and handle things. And you know, we're trying to hearts and minds type operations, but it was more about just trying to build, boost their economy, trying to give them reasons not to try to kill us. And trying to do things and trying to look after and promote good things instead of always kicking down doors, trying to capture the next bad guy. We were in the streets trying to build soccer fields, trying to completely rebuild their hospitals, trying to give them something to be proud of. And the one that was to show them that we want to do these things for you, and we do care about what happens whenever we're gone. We you know, it's just one. It was difficult. It's difficult when you're fighting a war, and then you have this other. You got the coin, the counter op, the counterinsurgency operational stuff, but you also are sitting down with tribal leaders, trying to get them and persuade them to have people back off and show them, you know, here's some money we're going to do. It was just so much going on during that deployment. And it was getting to be in the worst times on the ground, as far as danger goes. That's when they started the EFPs, explosively formed projectile, or explosively formed penetrator, which was the probably the only thing on earth I've ever been just simply scared to death of them. But you know, all that's going on, and we're still just trying to get by, man. But it was an interesting time during that deployment. My brother and I got to reenlist together on my mom's birthday.
How she felt about that?
He fucking hated it. Not near as happy as me and my brother assumed that she would be.
Right.
I mean, it was just one of them things. You know, we forgot how awful and how hard the military was on her. Yeah. Because my brother, of course, was wounded really bad too in 04. And he's got artificial hips, plates in his head. I mean, he was hurt really bad. So, well, this deployment's going on. One of my big things I do every week is go and meet with this guy. I ain't gonna say his name. I was trying to.
That's kind of
bad if I was gonna say his name or not. I ain't. But he was a mayor / leader of this of Jizr Diyala.
Was he a militant at all? Was he in the military, the Iraqi military?
Yeah, he was a general and one of Saddam's top dogs for a while.
Okay.
Not necessarily an inner circle guy, but he was trusted.
Okay, I got it.
The thing is though, he was a money man. He was like a wannabe mob boss. Well, I mean, not even wannabe. He was a mob boss. Especially when it starts, insurgencies is happening and all this stuff, and you know, there's a lot they could do, a lot of bad stuff they could do and blame it on somebody else, a lot of stuff they were getting away with. But I didn't give a damn. I had a job to do, and I wanted to use him to help facilitate me getting that job done. My job.
So, Brad, what was the reason that you kind of like, not say befriended, but got in cahoots with this dude? What was your main objective?
Befriended is okay. That's actually probably a good way to term it. It didn't necessarily start that way. I wasn't trying to be his friend, but you know, you keep your friends close, and then he had Jizr Diyala was a horrible place. That's where a lot of death. I mean, we drive by there on a patrol one evening. or one day get out walking through the market and all, and then we'd come back through there at nighttime and there's seven people lined up in the street with no heads. Huh. And be because they talked to us while we were walking through the market or something crazy like
that. That insignificant would make them lose their head.
Yep. And so it was a bad spot. And he run it. He was in charge. Well, there was a couple things. We wanted to get the police station up and running and all the stuff that they needed. And then there's a clinic, medical clinic we wanted up and running, and a big soccer field. And these three things were that was my baby. I wanted to have these things done on top of all the other stuff we were doing. I knew he had pull. This guy, people listened to him, whether it was out of fear or whatever, people listened to this guy. So I went and met with him every week. And the first time I met with him, I had 10 grand in my pocket that I had signed out. All the money we found and confiscated, whatever, we put it into a fund in our unit. And we could go sign that money out and use it for projects or whatever. We had to keep track of it, clearly, but we could use that money for stuff like that. So I had this money and let him know, this is why I'm here. I got this much money and I'll have this much money the next time. Every time I come here, I'm going to have at least 10 grand in my pocket. He thought I was full of shit at first until I showed it to him right before I walked out. I said, okay, you don't believe me? That's too bad, because you could have had some of this. And he's like, whoa, 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 holy shit. Sit back down, sir. Because this was completely out of the norm. This is something different that I was trying to use what I thought about his personality, you know. So I took it. Well, it wasn't the first time. It was probably after a meeting or two with him, I felt him out and realized that's how I could play. I could play like that, and it would more than likely work. Yeah. And I told him, I said, this money right here, it's your money. The thing about it is, for this money, this is what I want. This is what I need. And that was kind of our bargaining deals. I would bring him cash and a project. And it, you know, our dudes, however, we had contracted guys. We had guys that we could contract or whatever to do this work. Sometimes he had them. Sometimes he had the contractor guys. But we ain't wasting our time coming over here and going to do security on a dirt soccer field for the next month until it's built. You do that. You gonna have guys do that. Some of these military are cops, you know. So he had his part and I had my part to keep my dudes up from having to do it. We ain't playing this silly shit. You can take care of it. We just, for this money, this is what's going to have to be done. And this is the deadline. It's got to be done by this day. Not one time did he ever renege. Not once. Every time he said he was going to do something, every time I gave him a dime, 100% of the time he followed through. So, I mean, it was a great relationship. Did not many people knew what was going on and how I was doing right. Things. But after a certain time, I wouldn't have cared if they caught on, because I could justify everything. You know, that all people knew was shit was happening. Good things were happening. The school's done, blah, blah, blah. All this stuff's getting done. But so I'm working with him, and now it's my time to go on mentor leave.
Right. Yeah.
In June, I sent all my dudes. Now it's my turn. So I go and I let him know, hey, man, got another guy coming in that's going to take my spot while I'm gone. Don't say shit about what we got going on here.
Keep that shit on the DL.
Keep it on the DL. If you want to keep getting it, because I said, I ain't done nothing wrong. And I can back, but you start playing games with this other guy, he says something, it's going to stop. I'm not going to get in trouble, but I guarantee you, I don't get to come down here. I won't be able to sign out that kind of money anymore, regardless of what we're getting done, just because it's, you know, it'll show that you're just getting greedy.
Right.
Just don't do it. And I said, I'm going to tell him, whoever's taking my spot, I'm going to tell him, just sit there, come to these meetings and keep his mouth shut. And that's it. So don't try to big boy him. Don't try to intimidate him or get something else out of him.
Yeah.
Because I'm expecting you to do that. But if you do, when I come back, it's over. So I kind of laid down the law with him. He was like, absolutely. I had no reason to believe that he wouldn't do exactly what he said. Because
he's been 100% with you the whole time.
Yes, and he's living large and he's making bank. He's making money. But he's also given me everything that I've asked for. So it's working out for everybody involved, including the Army as a whole. So I go and leave, come back, and I'll try to. I don't want this to get drug out too long, but I come back, and I mean, literally, as I step off the aircraft, I'm getting yelled at. We got an operation, Sergeant Lloyd. We've been waiting on you. What do you mean? What the hell? I couldn't figure out what was going on. My dudes are lined up, ready to roll out the gate. I thought it was some trick, and turns out they were like, yeah, General so-and-so said that he knows where hostages are or something, but he'll only talk to you. And I said, that's bullshit. I mean, y'all fell for that. Like, that's what I was thinking. He wants something and he's trying to make it seem, he just wants to get y'all riled up, and it's worked. Like, why the hell does he only need to talk to me? I ain't been here for 2 weeks. Yeah. And he's talking to people. So why now? I didn't necessarily right then put together that he probably knew exactly when I was coming back. I mean, I'm sure people have told him that I'm fixing to be back. And that's probably why he was pulling that. He knew I was close. Well, so I still wasn't sure. I run upstairs. They're like, hey, we got new body armor, side plates, all kind of garbage. I had to get my driver to put them on. I didn't know how to do it. I had to run upstairs and get the patrol brief. And because I was not in the mindset to be going straight out into the streets.
You just got off a damn airplane.
Yeah, I'm still thinking about being at home. I still got that smell in my nose.
Yeah.
But I get up there, and once I talked to the commander and all, I was like, yeah, it's legit. I mean, it was not what I thought. It's this legit operation that I'll take it. So we get down in the truck. I realize I got a brand new truck, had 6 miles on it, just enough to put it on and off of a ship to get it there. Brand new 1151 armored Humvee. But bad thing is also got a new IED jamming system, completely different than what I'm used to. So much was different. And so many red flags were just hit me in the face that you don't need to go out this gate. I mean, the red, green, or the Warlock new IED jet, so much, man. It was just all in my face. We get to the gate and we roll out, and less than 1 mile outside that gate, boom, 655 millimeter artillery shells destroyed my truck.
Damn. And while you were in it,
while I was in that rig. Yeah, I mean, and it was bad, man. I remember that thing being so big and just trying to breathe in. My mouth had so much dirt, so much sand in my mouth that I couldn't take a breath at all, in or out. So I remember suffocating. I felt like I was suffocating. But I remember thinking, I'm drowning.
Right.
But if you're drowning in water, even if somebody's got their foot on your head, you know for a fact, if you can just struggle hard enough and hit them the right way, you can get to the surface and get a breath of air.
So, Brandon, what the hell did those people see after that truck blew up? After, what did they see? What did they see?
The Well, first off, the rear truck told me that they didn't react and come up there because they thought my vehicle was disintegrated.
Yeah. Oh, it was that bad.
Massive. Well, the vehicle catches on. I'm realizing I'm broke. I got blood coming out of one arm, but I forced myself not to look at it. My driver is somewhere. He's been blown out of the vehicle, I think. And then my gunner's up there bleeding on me. I broke his legs and all, getting slammed into him. But now the vehicle catches on fire at my feet, and I'm like, not the kid. I gotta go. And I somehow managed to get out of this blown to pieces. Just erupting in flames, just fire everywhere. I managed to get my gunner out and put him over my shoulder and run to the lead vehicle. And of course, yeah, you and I have talked about that. Is like, I hope this motherfucker sees that you still ain't getting me. As big as that was, I'm not only am I alive, I'm still walking.
Packing a son bitch on your shoulder.
Hell yeah. And I'm going to work on him, and then I'm going to work on myself. I hope you watch every second of it, asshole. It takes more than that to get me, which it would kind of not play out quite as tough guy as that, because once I got done with treating my gunner driver, and then I treated myself, I realized I was really bad off. And I pretty much collapsed. I'd lost a lot of blood, had a punctured lung, ribs were broken, 7 burst fracture vertebrae, crushed right foot. I was bleeding out of my eyes and my ears. Just blown to shit. They got me. But it didn't kill me.
No. But what happened while you're on leave to instigate all that, though?
Well,
that had to have happened.
I would come to find out, but it was kind of later. I ended up in the 10th cache, the combat support hospital in the green zone, supposed to be on a flight to Landstuhl, but I used my rank and my medical. I used my rank and being a senior medical dude to get on a flight back to my dudes, and just didn't let anybody think that's not where I'm supposed to be. Everybody thought, where the hell are you here? You're supposed to be in Landstuhl. No, they changed it. I'm supposed to be right here. And I mean, I didn't tell them that I had that big Chinese jump boot cast on my right foot all the way up to my knee. I threw that rig out of the helicopter. Gone. I hope somebody on the ground needs this bitch, because I ain't wearing it. But I got back to my unit, and about 10 days after I was blown up, I was back in my truck for a lot of reasons, and ego, and a lot of that played into it, just not wanting anybody else to do my job. I can do it better than anybody, and I believe that. But I also had one buddy that took my truck one time and lost his foot. He was hit and lost his foot, and I felt awful.
Yeah.
I allowed him to do that for not really a real big reason. But I just wasn't going to let that happen again. So I know when somebody's got to do my job, if I ain't there, I wanted it to be me, if there's any possible way. So I made that happen. I'm back in the truck. And about three now, my best friend on earth, Kenny Jenkins, gets killed in August. And it was right before that. So about a month later, I come in and I seen a flyer or a piece of paper laying on the table. And I thought one of my dudes had made it just as a joke. And it turns out that for whatever reason, while I was on leave, the general or the mayor that I was talking to and had built such a good relationship with, apparently however he was doing it, he drew a lot of attention to himself. I did everything to avoid that attention. However he was living, I don't know. I don't know what happened to draw that attention to him, but it was the Al-Zarqawi. Was that during that time frame? which was the after bin Laden, he was number two in Al-Qaeda. But it was his crew that had apparently gotten pissed off at this guy, at this general, and said, make it stop. Whatever you're doing, you know, just like the mafia, if they're not getting their cut,
make it go away.
Make it go away. And however you got to do it, make this shit go away. Because it was working, honestly. The good things we were doing was working. And that's the word that was spreading. And they couldn't have that. You're not going to have insurgencies and people willing to go kill themselves and blow if their family's good and their kids are good and everything's fine and they got a park and they got a soccer field. If you got all that shit, you don't have a bunch of evil ass people running around trying to kill people.
Right.
That's what they wanted. So, and this is just my thinking into it, because I was not privy to that conversation. I just know somebody said, make it stop. And apparently he didn't want to sit down face to face with me and say that. And also they could have possibly given him direction or given him, Lloyd's got to be gone, take him, whatever. I don't know. I don't know how the conversation went, but we use these little things to give out to Iraqis. We threw them out of helicopters all over. They're these small little flyers. It's got phone numbers on them, little Iraqi pictures, or if they need something replaced because we broke it, whatever it is, there's phone numbers and everything on it. Well, they had taken one and blew it up and put basically a wanted poster that was for me. But the crazy thing about it was there's so many, we're so used to seeing these things everywhere, all over telephone poles, you know, if you need help, call this number, blah, 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 all these things. So unless you walk right up to it and look at it, you don't even realize it's actually been manipulated. And now it has my picture on it for talking about, I wish I had one here to show you, but it's like 100 grand or a million and a half Iraqi dinar for me dead, my body. I'm like, what the fuck?
And it had your pictures on there of you, like, just not knowing that your picture's being taken.
Yeah, no, absolutely not. And both pictures on there are right outside of his office that I would meet at every week. So it was not hard to figure out he was the one that was in charge, that was responsible. But then when you think, damn, these things have been up the whole 2 weeks I've been on leave. And when I come back from leave, within 10 minutes, I'm blown to pieces.
The bad thing about it is, nobody, because that same guy that your replacement where you're on leave was going there, and it blended in so well, he didn't even notice it.
Nope. Damn. Yeah, it was normal to see these things all over the place.
Basically hidden in plain sight.
Yeah, and it took one guy doing a dismounted patrol walking just right next to it, looking at it and saying, hold on, why aren't Lloyd on that one? And that's how they found him. But
holy shit.
Apparently a lot of people wanted that money because just the fact that, I mean, the first time I leave the gate, within a mile, I'm done.
I'm thinking, Brandon, like you, the first time you met with this Yahoo, you were offering 10 grand to put security while the soccer field is being built or whatnot. 10 grand ain't a lot of money. And it was going to pay for security guards from telling how long. This ain't what 100 grand to do to somebody.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money in Iraq.
And it really sucks if that money would have been money that, because I gave him probably.
Yeah.
To think that the money I gave him was going to turn around and be the reward for somebody to kill me.
So you sustained, even though you came out looking like Billy Badass, you still sustained a lot of injuries from that incident. So it kept you in the bed for what, 10 days?
Yeah. And the crazy thing was the way my feelings were hurt, but they kind of were. I felt betrayed by him just because, you know, you build a relationship over a certain time. Now, trust me, I knew who he was. I didn't let him too close, but still, as a working relationship, it worked. And I couldn't understand the disconnect and why it would get to that point when we're still, like, we didn't have a falling out. I mean, money was still swapping hands. Good things are still happening.
And you gave him a heads up. Look, no money for 2 weeks while I'm gone.
That's why I knew somebody an outside party come in and didn't give him much of a choice. But
did he get his?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Either way, he was running that town and that city and had those flyers done. And I put one in my back pocket and I had it the whole time. And I went back and I met with this dude every single week, just like nothing had happened. Knowing every time I went in there, I knew that this dude is trying to get all these people to kill me, but I just never showed it. And I went in there and met with him and till the last day, right before we left to go home, my last meeting with him, as I walked out the door, I reached in my back pocket and I pulled this thing open and I threw it on the thing. And I can't remember my exact words, but it was kind of like, so I can't remember. I don't even want to mess it up by saying what it was, but I basically put it on the table. That was kind of the punchline. Yeah. Was for me to put it there and was like just kind of shaking my head in disappointment. And you can see on his face, he knew exactly what I meant. He knew. Right. And because he was in just like, damn. And he wanted to talk. He wanted to, yeah, but no, I got to go. You just lucky I didn't kill you. Yeah. That just shows that I'm a better man than you. I'd have got nothing out of murdering him. I mean, you know, it's just one of those things. That's those things that you do that you make decisions that are it's not that it's easy to kill somebody. It's never been easy to kill. It is easy to kill people, to be honest. It's easy. Living with it's the hardest thing. Living with it. I could have easily killed him. I wanted to. But trying to go back and justify it and it's something that would have stuck with me. And that's not what I wanted to do. I live better now knowing that I was like, I just held my head high. I was like, it's going to take more than that, Bubba.
Yeah.
Take a lot more than what you got to take me out.
Definitely. So is he still the mob or whoever end up getting him? Do you know?
Yeah, they ended up getting him. I think he ended up getting killed not like the next year.
Oh, okay.
It seems like somebody told me what happened. I got details about it, but I don't remember what.
Right.
Alvar Cowie, we got him, and then his loyalist and his little clan, they kind of dropped one by one after that. And I think he might have been part of that group, that crew.
Yeah. Well, there's a few more things I want to talk about before we wrap up today. I just kind of want to go over your series of injuries you sustained, because unfortunately you did retire, but you medically retired at 17 years. You didn't get to finish your 20 years, unfortunately. So what kind of stuff did you sustain that caused that?
I had 7 burst fractured vertebrae in my neck, mid and lower back. So I broke my neck and back, crushed my right foot, punctured my lung, broke my ribs in half, had a very significant traumatic brain injury. And really, that's it.
That's it. Like, that's it. That's a lot, man.
But I don't let it keep me. I've had 6 spinal surgeries. I don't let it keep me down, but I have to find a happy medium, because I've learned that you can't try to be a tough guy or try to act like you're good to go. Like I do, you know, my job is to, I don't want people to look at me and think, I want them to be completely shocked when they realize how bad I was wounded.
Yeah.
Like that's how I carry myself. I want you to never know I was wounded. But you can't do that and then get pissed off when your mama asks you to come do this. And yeah. You're like, huh? Mom, don't you know I've had, she's like, I don't want to hear that shit. I don't care about the spinal surgeries. You up here doing 28 mile road marches with 100 pounds on your back for fallen soldiers. You can come over here and help me put this fence up.
So she don't buy that shit.
Yeah, you don't. So I had to learn my new normal, learn my limits. I'm still learning them. the last couple of days have been really rough. My neck is really bothering me. Doing these events and flying and being in those crowds and all that, kind of my anxiety kind of will flare up, and then that'll in turn, that kind of shows itself with me through pain and tension, through tension, main, which turns into pain for me because I've got so much nerve damage and so many issues. But I'm happy because I don't let it stop me. I've let it slow me down, and I'm okay with that. But I hadn't let it stop me.
The first episode at the precursor to our intro, we read off a bunch of awards, you know, Bronze Stars, Purple Hearts, Valors, Kay Ivey presented you the Alabama basically Medal of Honor for Alabama. What's the most proud award as far as like what means the most to you?
You want the truth?
Yeah.
I've had three of my soldiers get silver stars.
Yeah.
For their actions in combat. By far, that is the proudest moments of my life to see them get awarded silver stars. Was the biggest accomplishment at the time, for sure.
I get it, man. I get it, because you know what you can do, but when you can lead people to do what you know they can do,
yeah,
I get it, 100%. So right. What's B. Lloyd doing these days, man? Newly married, still a few months now.
The best friend, yeah. We and everything's going great there. Trying to be the best daddy I can be. And I'm always in the middle of something. I got this safe haven that we're still out there trying to move it right now and trying to relocate it. It's a nonprofit recreational recovery and rehab is what I like to call it. Just helping guys transition, getting the VA, getting them on board with the VA and in the system, and also trying to get them set up on some little recreational fishing trips and art therapy and stuff like that. And it's working good. Had been doing that about a year, and I'm the senior administrator for that, and do a lot of speaking events. Got a book that I'm trying to release here in the next few months, which that's been tough. The speaking things, talking to kids, going to these schools and talking, I really enjoy. The other big events, not as much. I've just kind of gotten to a spot where if when I'm deciding, do I take this or do I not take it? It's not about just the money or how much I'm getting paid. It's does this fall into, and does this promote my goal? The goal that I have in mind, is this going to help me get there? And if something's not, then I just kind of put, you know, there are things you can do for fun. I get it. But when it comes to these things that I'm doing, if it is just for fun, or if it is, it's not going to help me get closer to that end result, then I'm kind of leaving those things on the side right now, and just only focusing on those things that will help me get to where I need to be, which is somewhere in the future where veterans are not committing 22 suicides a day. I'm bouncing back and forth to all the high schools in Mobile, getting plans set for each one of them to have a veterans memorial, bridging that civilian veteran divide, man. And trying to get in the ear. I want these veterans memorials to be visible, and for everybody that walks in these schools, they see them. And just things like that, man. I got the Daughters of the American Revolution nominated me, and I got approved for the distinguished distinguished citizen of the year award.
Awesome.
Which is mind blowing to me. So good things are happening, but yet I just can't, I have to always remember that I'm still struggle every day. But I get up and I have these things, and I put one foot in front of the other and try to be a good dad and then treat every situation like my daughters are watching me. And I feel like doing it that way has helped me more than anything else I've ever instilled or in anything else I've ever tried to learn something. Just doing things and treating people like my daughters are watching. It's easy.
Yeah.
And then my life has been much better by living it that way. Right. And when they are there, they do, because they're not always. I still treat a situation that's like they are there, but even when they're not, but when they are there and I act like that, they get to see the definition and what a man is and how a man should act and how a man should treat a woman, a female, all these things that you can do by acting like that and carrying yourself that way. You know, when my daughters are getting older, I got a 16-year-old who's a model, beautiful, almost tall as me. And I feel by living the way I live, when she starts dating and all this stuff, she's going to know immediately when she's not being treated the right way. Yeah. You know, so you and I are what men are in their eyes. And so they should see the best representation of that and know what to look forward to going through life. That goes for your boys and girls. Daughters, they got to be find somebody, an intimate partner, but boys too. It's good to have your dad as an example if you're a boy, knowing how to handle situations yourself when you get older. So just one of them things, man. I'm still not taking myself too seriously. Still trying to barter for shit. I traded some military gear for a riding lawnmower. I'm trying to pimp it out now, paint it green with the star on it, and gonna put some numbers on the back, make it look like an army truck.
Do navy blue. All right, gray like a ship.
Huh? It's got wheels on it, Junior. I might do a Heath version. I might do an E14 podcast version if you will put it on your website.
I'll put it on my damn website. I'll put it all over.
I might have one half Army, one left side Navy.
There you go. Your papa was in the Navy, so you need to.
My granddaddy did serve on the USS New Jersey, but I was on the USS Indianapolis.
I forgot you're a movie star too.
I'm a movie star.
So, hey, one thing else I want to talk about. You got a song named after you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You can even, hopefully, you'll be able to play the song leading into the episode if you want to.
I'll do it at the beginning or the end. It's getting played. Okay. But let's talk about that guy real quick.
Yeah, I do want to talk about Eric, man. Eric Erdman is one of the best people I've ever met in my life, one of the most intelligent. And he's also one of the best singer-songwriters that you could ever hear. And he's a true form, real guy that believes in his art. And I've seen him myself turn down big opportunities because he knew it was not going to allow him to do his work his way. So he's never sold out. He's just a great dude. We got to know each other really well. We've known each other as acquaintances for a long time. We got to know each other over the years, and he would come up and see me at Fort Campbell, and I'd come home and we'd visit or whatever. And then after I retired, we kind of got closer. But he does USO tours. He's all over the world. He travels worldwide on his tours doing his music. But he just through our talks and conversation and him getting to know me, he spent about 2 years writing a song. I never knew it. He never told me. He put a lot of time into writing this song. And it's my story. And he says my name in it. So ain't no denying. Yeah. But he uses me as to represent other wounded guys or combat veterans that are trying to transition home, and this, how, you know, the hard times that we go through with what we're dealing with, and how he even talks about the, when I nearly took my own life for when I wanted to, and the emotions and what I felt like at that time. It's just a very unbelievable song, but he even went a step further, and everything in that song has a purpose. He made it kind of upbeat. It's not, you know, one of those slow songs that'll make you miserable or sad as hell every time you hear
very,
it.
Very bluesy.
Yeah, he wanted me to have something that I did not avoid listening to. Mm-hmm. He wanted me to be able to listen to it. And so he put my favorite instruments in there. I mean, he did it freaking awesome. And I found out at the album release party, and I'm just like, what the wow. I tell you, a lot of people, if they were to have us, especially for somebody like him, if they had a song written about him and on their neck, they would share that shit through the rooftops with good reason. I get it, but I didn't. I kept it quiet for a while, maybe because I didn't really know how you handle this. How do you react when somebody's done this for you? But then I started sharing it when I thought some people needed to hear it. I would share it with buddies, somebody that's struggling. I've been in an inpatient facility a couple of times. I've shared it with people there. I didn't just put it on my Facebook and say, hey, y'all listen to this song Eric wrote about me. I've tried to kind of keep it out of the spotlight so it's not too worn out to where every time somebody hears it, it has a lot of meaning, and they'll appreciate it a little bit more, I believe. Because it's deep. It's a deep song.
Yeah, definitely, man. I'll definitely put that intro, outro, and then the website to hear it.
It's Eric Erdman, and the song is called Can't Feel It, F-I-L-L, Can't Feel It.
Yeah, and it's got that title has so many different meanings in the song. Yeah. Awesome song, man. And we just spent the better part of 2 hours hanging out with Brandon Lloyd, war veteran, war hero, American badass, or in his case, unique breed of badass. And, brother, thanks for spending the time with me, man.
You know, I always love it, man.
Hell yeah. Too bad it couldn't be in person, but, you know, our schedules are kind of crazy right now. Dude, I'm going to close out. Please hang out with me for a second.
All right.
And with that, we wish you fair winds and following seas.